OMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Dancing Babies, Aretha Franklin, Nielsen Stats and Elton John. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, who is business editor of CMU. Hello.
Is that my intro?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I couldn't think of anything else this week.
The enemy's going free today.
Oh, yeah.
As this podcast goes out.
Yeah.
Copying us, really, because CMU Daily is free, CMU Podcast is free, CMU website is free. Enemy, obviously, were looking at all of the stuff we were doing, and they were like, yeah, what we need to do is be free.
Yeah, you can get CMU at train stations.
If you've got
a smartphone on you.
Yeah. And so at universities and in trendy fashion shops.
Yeah, yeah.
And outside universities and railway stations and trendy fashion shops. So we have wider distribution than
yes,
the NME.
We are more popular than the NME.
Indeed. Let's forget about NME.com and all of that. But yeah, so obviously as we record this, all we know about the new look NME is that Rihanna's on the cover.
Yes.
So that's interesting. I suppose that the challenge, 300,000 of these they're distributing, so they've got to reach a wider audience in print than they used to with the paid-for edition, because they were only trying to keep...
They're worried that no one will be interested in the Libertines.
I think that's what it is. I mean, obviously, the 22 people who used to buy the print edition would love the Libertines to be on the cover, but that's not enough now that it's free. So Rihanna on the cover, so that's interesting. So, but that's all we can say, because as we record this, it ain't out yet. We can't tell you any more than that. The only thing that the publishers of the NME seem to be keen to tell us was that they've sold more advertising in this issue than any other issue in a certain number of
than
years.
Than all the other NMEs ever published put together.
I think it was the most advertising for 15 years or something. But that's... obviously, we weren't talking
to
the editorial
people. Well,
let's
look forward to week two, then.
We were talking
how that goes.
The commercial people were particularly excited about all this. So make sure, once you've listened to this podcast, that you go out to your local railway station or university or trendy fashion store and pick up a copy and look at all of those adverts. There are going to be lots of great ads in there.
It's what everyone's looking forward to.
So go in there and enjoy the first free ad-packed edition of the new Musical Express. But that's not what we're here to talk about today.
No.
You didn't say NME in the intro.
I did not.
Because we're not here to talk about it.
No, so let's not talk about it.
I will not talk about it.
Let's talk about Dancing Babies instead.
Okay, talk about Dancing
Babies.
Because
Dancing Babies are a pivotal thing in the music industry, as we all know.
Although I have to think that the Dancing Baby we're talking about, A, was more of a toddler than a baby, even when this was first news.
Yes.
And that is now 8 years ago.
Yes.
So almost, I imagine, a dancing teen by now.
Maybe not dancing at all.
Maybe not.
Not dancing, not a baby.
So, yes, this is a very long-running case that has been working its way through the American courts. And this week wasn't even a resolution of the case.
No.
It was a resolution of part of the case. And the case continues. So this was an American woman in 2007. She filmed a little bit of footage of her child dancing to a Prince track. Andy's going to tell you which Prince track.
Let's Go Crazy from 1984.
There you go. 1984, really?
Mm.
Wow. Is it that old?
Yeah.
So the kid was dancing to the track. Uploaded it onto YouTube because, you know, YouTube was quite new at the time. Let's get my kid on YouTube dancing to this Prince track. That was all fine. But then the big bad Universal Music Publishing, who were just sort of getting used to the whole takedown system with YouTube, Universal Music Publishing issued a takedown notice saying, we control the publishing rights in that Prince track. You did not come and ask us for permission to have your baby dancing to it. So we're taking the track down. So they had the video blocked. But then I don't quite know what sequence of event then happened. But basically, the mother of the child teamed up with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which we've talked about before on the podcast.
Yes, we have.
And they said, this is fair use.
Yes.
And therefore, Universal should not have taken the video down, and subsequently YouTube put it back up. And that in taking it down, that was an abuse of the takedown system. And therefore, the mother, who'd had to suffer the indignity of having her video of her dancing baby taken down, should be due damages for the heartache caused by Universal Music Publishing for having her video taken down. So this is all 8 years ago now, and it's been rumbling through the courts ever since.
Yes, it's been going back and forth with rulings, appeals, more rulings, etc. It's now reached the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the US, which is one of our favourites, I think.
It is. They appeal on cases in various Western states, I think, California being the relevant one here.
And that court was specifically considering whether fair use has to be considered when issuing a takedown notice.
Yes, that was one of the key arguments in this case, that Universal Music Publishing were questioning exactly what role this principle of fair use has in the takedown process, and also whether or not having your fair use rights ignored in this process should mean that the copyright owner was liable for damages. Now, fair use is quite an abstract concept that exists under American copyright law. Over here in the UK, we have something that's a little bit similar called fair dealing. And it's a slightly abstract line in copyright law that says there are certain scenarios where you can make use of copyright material without permission from the copyright owner, without a license, but we consider it to be fair use, fair dealing. So you're allowed to do it without getting permission, without getting license, without paying any money. And obviously, in copyright law, there are some very specific exceptions where it quite explicitly says, if you are doing this, you do not need a license. So over here in the UK, we have critical analysis. If you're showing a bit of a film in order to then critique the film, you do not need license. There's the private copy exception that we've talked about a lot on the podcast, which is an exception. So there are some specific exceptions where copyright law says, in these scenarios, you do not need a license. But then you have the slightly more abstract fair dealing, fair use, where it's much less specific. Yeah, perhaps that's fair use. And I think that was almost the point that Universal were making here, is that fair use is so nuanced to an extent, should it be the responsibility of a record company issuing a takedown to go through all of the thoughts processes of, well, could this be fair use? Could it not be fair use? And then also the question of, well, if you have your fair use right ignored, is there grounds for damages on that? What is there even a fair use right? What is the status of fair use? So it's quite a grey, abstract area of copyright law. And so it was that specific element of the case that this appeals court was considering. And their conclusion was, yes, fair use is relevant when you're issuing takedown notices.
Yes, so the court offered some clarification, which it then immediately made less clear. But it did say that a copyright owner must consider fair use before they issue a takedown notice. And if it is fair use, then they should not issue a takedown notice.
Yeah, so what that means is, if you are the person at a record company charged with managing your content on YouTube, so obviously YouTube has its content ID system through which record companies and music publishers, if they see their content being used by users uploading user-generated content, whether that be that they've nabbed some music off the TV and they're uploading it, or it's a cover version, or they've cleverly synced it to the track, or as in this case, it's just music in the background, the rights owner can go into the YouTube system and say, we own that copyright material, and either we want to monetize it, so give us the ad revenue that is generated by the video, or we want to block it, take it offline. And what this was basically saying is, when you're going through that process, it's not enough to say, that's our content, so we want it monetized or we want it blocked. Now you've got to say, that's our content. Oh, but hang on a second. Is that person's use of our content fair use? And if it is, then you have to say, okay, I'm not going to monetize, I'm not going to block, that person is allowed to use our content. Although, as I said right at the start of this, what is and isn't fair use is quite an abstract concept. And what they were saying was, providing you've considered whether or not it's fair use, you might say that it's not, and a court might say that it is, but that doesn't matter. Providing you've gone through the processes of thinking, is it fair use, is it not fair use?
Yeah, this is where it got a little bit less clear. Having been quite clear initially, the court
said, in fact, I think they said, to be clear, fair use must be considered, but then they fudged it.
Yeah, so they said it had to be a proper consideration. You had to sit down and really think about it quite hard.
And no lip service, they said.
Yeah.
No just pretending that you're thinking, oh, fair use, fair use, fair use. No. You had to give it some proper consideration.
However, if at the end of your long and deep thought about this, you decided that no, it was not fair use, then that was fine, even if a court subsequently disagreed.
Yes, so if the person whose content was taken down then took you to court, providing you could come to court and prove that you had considered that it was fair use, you decided that it wasn't, you had decent thought process for that, they did say you don't have to do huge amounts of investigation, which is just as well, given how much content gets uploaded to YouTube. You know, it's not that you have to, you know, investigate the content, get legal advice, but providing you've gone through the thought processes, then that is fine. But, I mean, that throws up various different dilemmas. I mean, first of all, the people who are sitting in a room somewhere making these decisions, so the content gets uploaded to YouTube, Content ID says your content's being used here, and then you're sitting there thinking, do I monetize, do I block, or do I ignore? Are those people qualified? Because they're not lawyers. You can't afford to have lawyers sitting at a computer doing this process. So are they qualified to decide what is and what isn't fair use, given that it's a bit of an abstract thing? And anyway, in 2015, most of this is done by a computer.
Yes. So in 2007, there was a person sitting there going, should this video be up? No, it should not. Let's take it down. But now, like as you say, there's a lot of content goes onto YouTube every second of the day. Hours and hours of it, so it's all automated now, and it's just, you know, it's bits of software going around picking out here and there where it finds, you know, bits of music that its company owns. It's all automated, and the court did
acknowledge
acknowledge this and muse on how a piece of software could pick up the nuances of fair use,
which it almost certainly couldn't. So they sort of had a get out there by saying, yeah, this is a bit complicated. Probably, you know, we're not saying that you can't do it automated. It seemed to me there was an element of, well, this much can be automated, but then this bit should be done by a human. But it wasn't clear to me how the automated bit was going to alert the human that they were required. And they sort of gave up on the whole thing by saying, but anyway, that wasn't relevant in this specific case, so we don't actually have to say anything conclusive on that incredibly important part of this debate. So it was interesting on various levels. It was interesting in terms of it moved this case on. The actual litigation being pursued by this, the mother of this toddler and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has had the support of big tech as well, the Googles of this world,
always helpful,
have given them their support. It means that the case can proceed to court. It also means that if they win, they can then push for damages and their costs, which was not a given back in the day when Universal first started arguing about this. So it's interesting in the context of this case, but it is also interesting in the wider element of the takedown system thing. We know that record companies and music publishers taking down content off all sorts of services, and especially YouTube, has become industrial now. We've automated a big chunk of it. We have teams who specialize in this. It is, you know, for a lot of record companies and some music publishers, it's part of the working day that you go through, you press some buttons and content gets taken down. And so, you know, what this is now saying is, well, be careful, because there is some provisions in the DMCA to stop rights owners from abusing the takedown system by basically just stomping around the internet, taking down stuff without even really thinking about it, perhaps taking down stuff that they don't really own. Some people are always concerned that could people use this for censorship. I think there was a thing about Kanye West reviews being taken down by a record company years ago. It was Kanye. And that was sort of saying, you know, are you taking them down because they put clips of the music and you don't want that for copyright reasons? Or are you actually taking these down because they're slightly negative reviews and you want them off the internet? So there is provisions in the DMCA. Most things in DMCA are a little bit ambiguous, but there are provisions to stop big music companies and copyright owners from abusing this system. And so what was interesting was saying ignoring fair use does constitute an abuse of the system. And, you know, you could get in trouble for that. You might be liable for damages for that. Although it's still not really clear how the hell this is going to be implemented in the day-to-day takedown machines that the big record companies now operate. And, of course, it goes beyond the US. There are people in Europe who are taking down content, which is also removed. You know, it could have been a European publisher who took down the content of this American user-generated content. And what would then happen from a jurisdiction point of view, in that the European rights owner could say, well, I'm not subject to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There is no fair use under my copyright system, certainly not of the American kind. So a little bit of clarity, but still lots of murky fuzziness.
Nobody quite fuzzy around
really
the
knows
edges.
What's going on.
Takedowns of a different kind now. This one relates to something more offline. A film. In 1972, a film was made about Aretha Franklin recording her live gospel album, Amazing Grace. But the music was never synced to the video.
Yeah, It
just lay in a vault and was never finished.
I'm quite confused about this whole story. But yes, so it was a film director who had permission to record. I think that it was a live recording, and as is often the case with live recordings, I think there was actually like two concerts or something. It was in a church. They filmed it. It was going to be this documentary. And then there was some problem with syncing the sound to the film that meant the film was never finished. And so it sat in a vault unwatched. The director has now died, but the producer is still alive. And I think in more recent years, he has managed to finish it. And there was some story about how he'd had to hire someone who could lip read to try and desperately match the recording with the visuals and make it all work. But anyway, this film, it's also called Amazing Grace, has been finished. It's ready to go. And the producer, Alan Elliott, was hoping to get it launched at some film festivals this autumn and then get a distributor and share with the world this 40-year-old recording of the great Aretha Franklin performing her live gospel album.
Yeah, it has been. It was booked into various film festivals. This is actually despite a 2011 bid by Aretha Franklin to stop the film ever being made public.
Yes, well, I think that litigation was settled out of court, so I don't quite know how it was settled for it to then all kick off 4 years later.
Yeah, because it was all. Well, so it started earlier this month with the. I don't know how they pronounce this, but let's just say Telluride Film Festival.
In America.
Which is in Colorado, in America. And it was booked. They had three screenings booked in. And right at the last minute, Aretha Franklin managed to get a court order saying that they couldn't show this film.
Yeah, so I think the festival was due to kick off on a Saturday morning on Friday at 5 p.m. And Aretha Franklin, because she was on the other side of America at the time, she had to phone in her testimony. But at the very last minute, they managed to get it cancelled. And at that stage, the producers of that film festival, what are we calling it?
Telluride?
Yeah, that one.
Telluride.
The producers of that film festival came to court. And first of all, they sort of said, well, it seems unfair that Aretha Franklin has come at such short notice. I mean, I don't know whether that was just because she didn't know about it until very short notice. But they said it will damage our reputation. It was weird because they were sort of saying it will damage our reputation if we have to pull it at this short notice. But then they said, but we're such a small festival, not many people will see it anyway. So it's sort of one level, you know, we're well known, it will damage our reputation. But actually, no one's ever heard of us, so it doesn't matter. And then there was talk of a contract, okay? And they said there's a contract where Aretha Franklin gave permission for the film to be commercialised. Although I think the conclusion with that was that the contract only covered the recording, because as you said, a live album came out of this project too, and that the contract they were presenting was only for the audio. It was not a pre-cleared agreement by Aretha Franklin to allow the film to be distributed.
So she then... So she had a contract. She had to approve any other use. So the film could not come out without her approval,
yeah.
The use of her image and intellectual property, etc.
Yeah, a verbal agreement, I think, had been made, or certainly this is what Aretha Franklin was saying, with the director, who is no longer alive, that although he could film the concert and the live recording being made, any actual distribution or commercialization of the film was subject to her approval. So there would have to be a contract agreed after the filming for anything to be distributed.
Yes, and having had success with a small film festival, she moved on to a bigger one, the Toronto International Film Festival, which is a big one. It's international.
Yeah, and initially when the American festival had to cancel it, Toronto put out a statement saying, we're still showing it.
You won't stop us. Ha!
But they didn't. Mm. Well, certainly not to the public anyway.
No, there is a claim by Franklin's legal team now that they still did a private screening for a few people from the film festival. But that's been neither proven nor disproved as yet. But publicly, certainly, it was not shown. It was pulled from the schedule. And now the producer, Alan Elliott, has agreed to a 30-day injunction, in which time he promises definitely not to show the film anywhere while negotiations go forward, which is weird. This seems to be a kind of a weird point at which the story splits. So Aretha Franklin is now suing to stop the film ever being shown anywhere in the world ever, but is also negotiating with the producer for a fee in order for him to show the film.
Yeah, so I suppose when Aretha Franklin's people first put in their injunction for the first film festival and then the second film festival and then subsequently the wider litigation, it wasn't initially clear why she didn't want the film to go out. And so it was like, well, is it autistic? Is it creative? Is it that she just, perhaps she, there's some reason why she doesn't want that event in her life to be made public, or perhaps she's not happy with the way, given that it wasn't finished at the time and then it's sort of been finished, you know, 40 years on. Is it that there's some reason, some emotional reason, some creative reason why she does not want the world to see this film? And then this week it's like, oh, well, actually, they're trying to do a deal. So it sort of feels like, well, this might actually be a financial thing, that Aretha Franklin is saying, I'll give you permission to shoot this film, but I want X. And Alan Elliott is saying, I don't have X, or I'm not willing to give you X. And actually, the whole dispute all along, certainly in recent weeks, has been a financial dispute rather than anything else.
Yeah, the Hollywood Reporter reckons that Franklin's people have estimated that Alan Elliott is going to make at least $2 million from this film, and therefore they want $1 million in order to give that approval they reckon they need to give.
It's interesting, because you'd think with a film of Aretha Franklin, that doesn't actually sound like a lot of money, either for how much the producer's going to make or how much she would command for a fee. Although I suspect that it was being positioned as being a bit of an art house film, and perhaps it wasn't going to go on general release and it wasn't going to be a big bucks movie. And therefore the producer is saying, you know, I can't afford to give you that money. Certainly, I mean, I get the sense they want $1 million up front. It's not that we want 50% of the money and we expect that to be £1 million. It's that they want the cash up front. And I sort of sense that this guy and his immediate business partners simply can't put their hands on that sum of money. This is me speculating quite wildly here, but I think that's sort of the gist of this dispute.
Yes, and I mean, and the willingness to negotiate on this would, as you say, suggest that this was about money all along, and they've kind of thrown their weight around a bit because negotiations weren't going their way, and they, you know, it was being screened or planned to be screened without any money changing hands.
And certainly,
the willingness to negotiate also suggests that they're not actually that confident in the lawsuit they've put forward.
Well, it makes the lawsuit a negotiating tactic, basically. I mean, if it looks, either because it actually gets to court or just through lawyers interpreting, that a US court could stop the distribution of this film, actually it is within the power of the court to say, yeah, this film cannot be distributed. You then have another, back to jurisdiction. I mean, what can the US courts do beyond the US? I mean, they could clearly do an injunction within the United States of America, but, you know, what about the rest of the world? And if you can distribute it worldwide but not in the US, well, is that even an injunction worth having? But you sense this is a negotiating tactic. If it looks like there could be any threat of this Alan Elliott guy never being able to distribute this film through injunction, then that's going to make him want to try and find the money to make sure he has all the paperwork.
Well, also, presumably, he's not, regardless of whether they have a strong lawsuit or not, he's probably not that keen on going through a lengthy legal process to get this out.
One lawyer quoted, I mean, obviously lawyers like suggesting more litigation because it's good for business, but there was one lawyer sort of saying he could almost countersue the fact that Franklin's team came in so last minute. You know, that was hindering his business to the screenings that he had planned. He's been, you know, damaged by that. And so could he countersue for Franklin's activities? Now, I have no idea whether there will be a case for that. That could just be lawyers trying to get more work. But I sense that actually none of this will get to court and a deal will be done. And sort of ironically, by this becoming a news story, because, you know, I think even the screening at the Toronto Film Festival would not have been particularly big news.
No.
Worldwide.
But now it can be the film Aretha Franklin tried to ban.
So now it's sort of become a global news story. I would suspect that the film is more marketable, which means the film will make more money. Now, of course, that might mean that Aretha Franklin's people come in and say, now we want a $5 million advance. But it might also mean that Alan Elliott can go and find distributors. I mean, obviously, the challenge he will say is, if I'm going to find a distributor to give me the money so I can pay the advance, the distributor's got to see the film. And if you're telling me I'm not even allowed to show it to distributors, then this ain't going to work. But it may well be that now this film is newsworthy, that it will be worth more money. He'll be able to find a backer and he'll be able to pay Aretha. And eventually we will get to see this bloody film. It better be a good film when we finally get to see it.
I don't think it matters if it's good or not. At this stage, it's just, you know, people are going to want to watch it because, like I say, it's the film she tried to ban. And, you know, for the most part, people aren't going to know that there was this bitter dispute over money. As far as anyone else is concerned, the majority of people are going to see that, oh, like Aretha Franklin doesn't want us to see this film for some reason.
Let's go and see
better
it.
Better go and see it to find out what's so awful about it.
Yeah. So, whereas, you know, if you've heard the album, I suspect, I don't know how much backstage footage or interviews or anything like that there is. Or whether it is just a straight performance. If it's just a straight performance, then it's just the album you've already got, but you get to watch us singing the songs. So I suspect a deal will be done. Someone will come in with the money. I mean, it may well be that he just has to pass the project on to a bigger studio and have some sort of consulting arrangement, and then they will be able to do the deal. So that may well be what now needs to happen. But I suspect the film will come out, and we will get to see it, and it will probably be a bit of a letdown given all of this hype. But Who knows? Perhaps it will remain in vaults forever.
Maybe.
Time now for that bit of the podcast where we get Andy Malt to justify to you, the listener, what possessed him to approve the tracks and artists that we have approved in the CMU Daily this
week. Set me up
week.
For a fall, why don't you?
So, hey, Andy Malt, yes. Tell us why you are such a big fan of Faulty DL.
Well, this isn't me.
No, it's not you.
It's not me. I do like Faulty DL, but not as much as Paul Vig.
Yes, he of Vigsy Club Tip fame.
Yes, he does also sometimes write the approved column outside his club tips. And this week he approved of Faulty DL's new single, Rich Prick Poor Dick, which is out today if you're listening to this podcast as it goes online.
So Faulty DL's most recent release wasn't as Faulty DL?
No, he released one under his real name, which is Drew something, beginning with L. It's DL. This is his return to... I mean, it's not like it's been a long break. He released an album with Faulty DL last year, but this is him returning to the moniker and Ninja Tune for the first time since he released his... I don't know, would you call it a solo album if he just released it under his own name?
Other moniker album.
Yes. Do you want to know what Paul Vig said?
Tell me what Paul Vig said in your Paul best Vig... Paul Vig voice.
I'm not going to do an impression of Paul Vig.
Well, no one would know.
Okay, this is exactly what Paul Vig sounds like. Taking more of a club-focused approach than the last Faulty DL album in the wild, the new single is a fast-paced techno offering, which starts slowly with beats made for fist-pumping on the floor before rolling along nicely, seemingly taking in a large swathe of influences from the European techno dance floors of the 1990s.
I'm sold.
That's what Paul sounds like, isn't it?
Yeah. Tinashe.
Tinashe. I don't know how to say it. I've never had to say it out loud before. This is a disaster. She's got a new single out called Party Favors. It is the first track from her new album, Joyride.
Which is not a Roxette covers album.
It is not a Roxette covers
album. Initially hoping.
Unfortunately for Chris Cook, who is a big Roxette
fan. I am.
No, this is a slow-paced R&B track produced by Boy Wonder, one of the many producers to work on her new album. It features rapper Young Thug. And I think if this track sets the tone for Joyride, then I think that's going to be a very exciting album to listen
to. Check out the track and look forward to the long player. Next, Kyla Lagrange.
Lagrange, you said that in the best French accent.
I did. I am French. Did you not know that?
Are you?
I just have a very good grasp of the English language.
Oh, I see. No, you don't.
I have a degree in English, I'll have you know.
Well, that's what we've heard.
Albeit from Scotland.
This isn't important right now. What is important is Kyla Lagrange has a new single out called So Sweet, which is the first track from her next album. And it's a very strong comeback for her. She has released two albums to date, neither of which have done anywhere near as well as they should have done, because she's good. And I thought, you know, I'd check what her chart positions had been when I was writing this. And she's never charted. No singles, no albums have ever charted in the UK, which is just ridiculous.
Yes. Who are we blaming, the British public or the chart?
I think we should probably just blame both.
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 The official charts company should have a special system in place whereby when she releases a record, that week they don't count anything. They just put it straight at number one.
Well,
that's what you're lobbying for.
I'm not sure that would be a fair system. All I'm saying is that you should listen to this new single and make it get in the charts, because, you know, she's going to get dispirited.
Yeah, but I bet when you provided this as an embed for our readers / listeners, I bet you did a SoundCloud embed which won't chart return. So it's your fault.
Don't go to the CMU website to read about this and listen to it. Go straight onto Spotify where it is, because it was released on Spotify as it went on SoundCloud.
And stream it 82 times a day to get it in the charts.
It's very good. What did I describe it as? It sounds like it's as the soundtrack to a heart-swelling montage from an 80s teen movie.
So there you go. Finally, this week in the approved slot, Dog in the Snow.
Dog in the Snow, a newer act, a duo from Brighton. They've got a new EP coming out next month called Uncanny Valley. The track you can listen to on the CMU website is called Proxy. It's a very eerie and beautiful introduction to their sound, and I think that is a fine description of their music, even if I do say so myself. It's a very good EP.
completemusicupdate.com/approved.
On to some stats now, and who doesn't like stats?
Stat of the week,
which I noticed didn't get a jingle last week. Well, it's still time.
Looking forward to the stat of the week jingle.
Yeah. This is from a, in fact, this is more than one stat, so we have to choose
stats
which one is our
of
favorite.
The week.
But Nielsen in the US has done a bit of a survey and published a report, its latest Music 360 report.
Yeah, it does this every year. Just over 3,000 people surveyed. They're all American, so, you know, this is giving us insights to the US market in particular, although I think the key trends that they found, a lot of them could be replicated worldwide.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, well, it highlighted things that we really already knew and have said many times in the past, that there are problems with streaming music going truly mainstream because the streaming services currently haven't reached a price point and service that really is attractive to mainstream music listeners.
Yeah, and although Daniel Ek, boss of Spotify earlier this year, insisted that Spotify was now, and I quote, mainstreaming.
Is that what he said?
That's what he said.
Jesus.
Spotify have impressive figures, so they have impressive premium figures, let alone, you know, the total number of users on the freemium element. Apple Music, if we believe, are well over 10 million now. So these services have relatively impressive figures, and the record companies are pleased with that, and the revenues are good. Having said that, worldwide, I mean, I think the IFPI, which is the Global Record Industry Trade Body, their report, their big stats pack earlier in the year, were saying just about over 40 million people were now paying to subscribe. So let's assume that that may well be up to 60, maybe even 70 million now, given Apple Music have whammed 10, 12 million on top of that. Spotify continues to grow quite fast, and there are all the others. But even if 70 million people are paying to access streaming music, worldwide,
that's not a lot of people.
It's not actually that many people. And I think there's two elements to this, which is firstly, not everyone is going to pay to stream music, okay? So because, you know, not everyone was buying CDs. You know, back in the day, a lot more people were listening to a lot more music through music TV and music radio than were going out and buying CDs. So, you know, the music industry has always had a freemium and a premium element in an extent, in that we were always reaching more people through channels, which, although we were getting royalties from TV and radio in the same way we get royalties from Spotify Freemium and from YouTube, we were reaching a lot more people through the free channels than we were by actually selling them CDs. So they're being free and paid for, and a lot more people taking free than paid for, is not new. But also the point that you just made there, which is, I think, you know, streaming can grow a lot more. It can get a lot more people signing up to pay rather than just being on the free services, but not at $9.99 a month. And the vast majority of streaming services in any one territory are now basically offering you the same service. It might look different, they might have some extra widgets thrown in, but basically Spotify, Deezer, RGO, Apple, when it comes to their premium offering, in terms of how much music you get for what price, it's the same service.
So Nielsen gave people that surveyed a list of reasons that they didn't sign up for a premium streaming service. And 46% of those people put right at the top of that list the $10 a month subscription, saying it was just too much money.
And I think a lot of people working in the music industry, and I think actually one person, when we reported on this earlier today, tweeted this, sort of saying, what are these people talking about? You know, 30 million plus tracks on demand whenever you want, the playlists and the discovery, new content going live every single week. What are these people talking about? £10 a month, that's a perfectly fair deal. The issue is that actually the majority of the population don't want 30 million tracks to choose from. They don't want to have everything on demand. They don't want every single new release available every Friday morning. So to an extent, we've built a service that seems incredibly good value to people who work in music, because it is incredibly good value if that turns you on. But actually, for a lot of people, we're asking for too much money for a service they don't actually want.
Yes, because, I mean, there are obviously a variety of reasons people would say that that's too much money. But top of 38% of people's lists was that they just didn't think they'd use a service enough to justify spending £10 a month or $10 a month on it. And that's, you know, as we've said before, most people are not spending £120, $120 a year on music. So you're asking them for a big jump in their outlay, and they probably aren't going to listen to it enough.
No, and suppose, and that sort of more specific line that people have ticked there is interesting in that those people are, it's not that they're saying it's not worth it. What they're saying is it's not worth it to me. Okay, because I get that if you're the sort of person who listens to music from breakfast till tea time and it's constantly on, then that's a good deal. But that's not me. I just want it there for a couple of evenings a week, and it seems like quite a lot of money for a couple
and
of evenings.
And if I wanted to listen to music morning till night, I'd just put the radio on, and that's
radio
free.
On. Of course, this is interesting time-wise because the Apple Music 3-month trial is nearing its end. So if you signed up to Apple Music on day one and you were getting it for free for 3 months, well, the 3 months are nearly up at the end of this month. And at that point, people will have to start paying Apple Music as part of that or ramping up their marketing. Because obviously, if you were to sign up to Apple Music for the first time today, you would still get the 3-month free trial. But they are now having to shift into the business of actually persuading people that $120 or euros or pounds a year is a good deal to have the on-demand streams. We know that back earlier in the year when Apple were first negotiating that they didn't want to do $10.
Yeah, they recognised that it was a problem.
And we heard that they were pitching at £5 or $5 a month, but still for the same service. And that was the problem, that they basically wanted to replicate everything that Spotify does, but offer it at a much lower price point. And I think the record companies in particular said, well, that won't work, because if you're basically offering the same service as Spotify at £5 a month and Spotify is still £10 a month, well, that will screw over Spotify. And while you, Mr. Apple, might like that, we don't like that, because Spotify is an incredibly important revenue stream. Now, it's the one booming revenue stream that's growing month on month. If we screw over Spotify, we screw over ourselves. So, well, I don't know whether they would have said, I suspect they just said you have to do it for £10. But perhaps they did say, well, is there a different service that you could offer? If you think that the price point should be $5 a month, what could we do that would be less than what Spotify offers, but which would justify the $5 a month price tag? I have no idea if those conversations went on. I think they should have gone on, because I think ultimately that is the solution to all of this.
Yes.
That there has to be a cheaper price point. Now, whether or not that's making what Spotify already offer for $10 available for $5 and then adding a load of other stuff on to justify $10, or whether it's somehow entering with a lesser catalogue service. People seem to think £2-3 a month is the price point that the mainstream will go for.
Yeah, and Ardio have set up a service where they've tried
to
hit
that. Yeah, they're trying to do it, aren't they? And with that, it's you get personalised radio and limited on demand, in that you have to choose which tracks you want in any one month. So they are experimenting with that sort of price point. Also, a lot of growth in streaming in the last 12, 18 months has really been because of mobile bundles. You know, so many streaming services now, if you buy a certain mobile phone package, you get the Spotify or the Deezer or the whatever bundled in. The problem is that When the price is £10 a month, even if you know there's a discount for EE and Vodafone because they're bulk buying subscriptions, even if they're getting it slightly cheaper, it's still going to be quite a big expense month on month, which means that the phone companies can only ever bundle that in with the quite expensive phone packages. If you've got to swallow £6 a month, it's got to be quite an expensive phone package before you can add a little extra £6 on there and the customer doesn't notice. Whereas if you could get it down to £2-3 a month, then you could start bundling music in with much, you know, more widely used phone packages. So that it would not only would we potentially sign more people up directly, it would mean that the mobile bundling part of the business could really expand and really grow. So it is the challenge of can we find the $2.99, the $3.99 service. I'm not sure audio service is it, although they are the one company that's trying to sort of dabble with a bit of variable pricing.
And then one of the challenges of setting up a £2 or £3 a month service is how do you make that better than the services people can get for free, such as Spotify Freemium, which is very good, or stuff like YouTube and SoundCloud.
Yeah, because the audio service that we mentioned, whatever it is, I think it's $3.99.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's even live over here yet, is it? But it's available in the US. I think that's a great little package that they've put together. However, unless you are absolutely adverse to adverts, you could say, well, Spotify Freemium, which is basically everything on demand on your PC, and they say it's not on demand on your iPad and your iPhone, but it's pretty damn close, that the Spotify free service is actually better than the service that Ardio is charging $3.99 for, providing the adverts are not a deal breaker for you. So with all those free services out there, how do we create £2, £3 services which aren't as good as the £10 service, but which are somehow better than these brilliant free services that are out there. And I mean, that was another one of the reasons that, that people gave in this Nielsen survey for not being motivated to sign up. Is if I want music on demand, I'll go to YouTube, I'll go to SoundCloud, I'll go to Spotify. It's all there anyway. Don't care about the ads. Why would I pay?
Which kind of brings us back to where we started, which is what do we do about freemium?
Yes, and as I said, I mean, it's not that we're getting rid of freemium, okay, because there has always been a free element to music consumption. And sometimes when this debate happens in the music community or the artist community, sometimes just the notion of there being any free sources of music is sort of frowned upon, even though there have always been free sources of music through radio, through TV. It's obviously the online free services have better functionality, which is the issue. So freemium is here to stay. It's just that, well, what does freemium look like? And there are quite a few people now who think that the sort of Pandora type service, which, and again, RDO is already doing this. Freemium is personalized radio like Pandora. Premium is on demand like Spotify. And then the middle one is somewhere in the middle. But how do we shift freemium over to personalized radio when people have got so used to YouTube and SoundCloud and indeed Spotify free and Deezer free? And this is the big debate that's been rumbling on. And YouTube and SoundCloud are the challenge, because while ultimately you can probably persuade Spotify and Deezer to amend their free services, they are going to be very resistant to that, and indeed are resistant to that, while they keep saying, but we're in competition with YouTube, we're in competition with SoundCloud, sort them out before you tell us to completely address freemium. And no one seems quite certain what to do about YouTube and SoundCloud. We know they're important. We know they have an incredibly big audience. We know that they're great marketing channels. We sense that there's some way of monetizing their free services, but we don't want them to stop people signing up to premium services. So that's the big challenge for the next 18 months, is what do we do about YouTube and SoundCloud? I say, what do we do? You know, not all of it's in our control. Certainly YouTube and Google have their own agenda. SoundCloud have their own agenda, albeit with the whole PRS litigation and the safe harbours debate somewhat constraining them. So, as you say, nothing in this research is a revelation. Nothing in this research is new, but it sort of reaffirms a lot of what we've been talking about for most of the year about where the streaming sector goes next.
Yes, it's a debate that is going to rumble on for some years to come, I think. But this at least gives some clarity in the middle of the confusion. Just a moment now to talk through a few of the stories we haven't had time to discuss fully on this week's podcast.
Or we haven't got that much to say about.
Well, Live Nation's done a deal with a bank.
And the only reason I even put this on the list is because of the... it's one of those classic mad billings. So, because like earlier in the year, Live Nation in the US announced that they now had an official lubricant for their venues. I can't remember what it was, but they had an official lubricant.
We discussed it on the podcast, though. And go back and find out.
Now, National Australia Bank, they've got a bit of the business that is wealth management. So it's not just the sort of the high street banking bit, their wealth management business. And that, what is it that they're calling it?
I think it's the superannuation partner.
The official superannuation partner of Live Nation Australia and their venues. I just think that that's a bit insane. So that's why I thought we would bring it up.
Well, Eric Schmidt, CEO of Alphabet, which you might think of as Google, has said that human creation in streaming services is elitist.
Now, he didn't just stand up to diss Spotify and Deezer and Apple, who've been making a big deal about the fact that their recommendation services have human input as well as machine input.
It was just a happy byproduct.
He was talking about artificial intelligence, wasn't
yes.
he? But he used it as an example. And although obviously he didn't specifically name check his competitors, it was an element of him sort of saying, yeah, all of you going on all the time about how we've got human beings doing the curation. My machines are better than your humans.
He's saying eventually, yes, artificial intelligence should evolve to a level where you didn't need human creation, because human creation is inherently elitist and therefore not as good as artificial intelligence could be.
Because it would be democratic.
Yes.
And we all know that when things are democratically selected, the finest of content is presented to us. So can't wait for Eric's machines to rule the roost.
Share Beast, is no more.
So this is a big file sharing service, particularly in the US. It's the latest one to have its domains seized by the American authorities, taken down. One of those sites that had various different outlets. As far as we can see, they've all been taken down. Don't know whether it will resurface off some other website somewhere in the world. But the record industry in America was very pleased by this.
Yeah, was it described as the largest US-based file sharing operation?
Yes, so within the jurisdiction of the American courts. So, yes, another little win of sorts on the old piracy thing, although presumably all the file sharers are off now using some other service.
Yeah, someone outside the jurisdiction of the US courts, Kim.com, where he appealed attempting to stay that way this week.
Yes, another update on the Mega Upload story, which we've included just for the benefit of Tom, who does some research and marketing for us at CMU, because yesterday he was very keen that we...
He said, don't put Kim.com in again.
Have a little Kim.com
update.
So
we won't.
So here it is. So yes, this is the long-running attempt by the American authorities to extradite the Mega Upload founder to the US. He had some new technicalities, it's the same technicalities, that he had arguments as to why the extradition hearing that's due to take place next week should be pushed back into 2016, which would make it, 4 years since Mega Upload was actually shut down and they were originally arrested. But he failed, so the extradition hearing should happen next week, although Kim.com's lawyers will have another attempt to kick it all back into next year. There were various arguments why that should happen. So it remains to be seen whether the Kim.com extradition hearing finally properly takes place in the next month or whether we are looking at another few months pushback.
Yeah. Prince released an album exclusively for Tidal users last week, and now anyone in the world can buy it.
But?
You have to buy your CD or download from Tidal's website. However, I saw someone claim this week that you could buy it in FOP. I don't know if that is true. I have not been to FOP.
To check.
No.
You didn't do your research to confirm or deny that.
But this is true and also quite funny that something that was billed as a big exclusive for Tidal is something that they're selling. I don't know if it's being used as a marketing scheme to get people to actually sign up to Tidal. I assume that's the reason. But it just seems a bit weird that if you go to Tidal.com, you can buy a Prince CD.
Yeah, so the future of digital music is now a CD
CDs.
Seller.
Yeah.
Perhaps that is the future.
Maybe it
Perhaps
is.
Perhaps they've cracked it. So, the future of digital music, selling CDs off your website. You heard it here first.
The future of digital celebrity worship is retweets. That was what Twitter found this week.
This was a Twitter study that reckons that retweets are the new autographs.
Yes, that was a funny way of saying autographs. Twitter, which you might say was a little bit biased in this, found that for many people, they would much rather have a retweet from their favourite celebrity than an actual autograph.
Or a selfie with was the other thing that they mentioned. Obviously,
yes, both of which more important than autograph. Well, I mean, Taylor Swift said in her Wall Street Journal article, whenever that was, a couple of years ago, that she hadn't been asked for an autograph since iPhones got front-facing cameras.
So there you go. I mean, autographs always were a bit odd. And so this probably doesn't even happen anymore. I remember going to an awards event. It was a jazz awards event and Tony Bennett was there. And there was a guy outside with Tony Bennett DVDs waiting for him to arrive to get it autographed. And it was like, oh, are you a big Tony Bennett fan? And he's like, oh, no, I just sell them on eBay. And there's a whole business on eBay of selling autographed DVDs. It's like, I've never managed to understand why having someone's name scribbled on something makes it more desirable than just the DVD. It's like when bookshops sell you signed. What difference does it make that they've scrawled their name in the front? Except that perhaps it has value that you can then sell on eBay. But why does it have value? So I've always found autographs a bit odd. So you seemed upset when you wrote up this story that
well,
the kids were putting retweets ahead of autographs.
I agree. I think autographs, especially in that circumstance where it's just like you're just buying something that someone's written on. If it's like a personal, if there's some personal connection, if there's something like a message to you written on it, maybe that's like this. I understand that a bit. But autographs themselves are weird. However, what I don't get why people want retweets. Like, I constantly see like Twitter accounts where people are going like, oh, it's my birthday, could you retweet me? And then they get their retweet and it's like, well, how is that of any use whatsoever. Some, like, well, like follows as well. Follows the other thing. There was, like, you see, like, Twitter accounts that are just, like, say, a One Direction fan where the only thing they've ever tweeted 30 times a day is, please follow me. It's like, well, what's going to happen when they follow you? You've then got a Twitter account which you don't say anything on. You don't use for anything. What value does a follow have to you or any or them? Like, why would they want to follow you? Go, oh, I'd love to follow you so I can see you tweet things at me, which they'd be able to see anyway.
So stop it.
Just stop trying to get autographs, retweets, anything. Everyone just do something better with your lives.
So there you go. That's our recommendation. Final story.
Final story is a thing you could do with your life.
Yeah.
You could...
wind up aging musicians on a admirable political cause.
I was going to say that you could campaign for better LGBT rights.
Is that what you were
around
going to
say? The world.
Not like, trick Elton John into thinking
no,
he's talking
I
to a president.
No, I don't think that's a good thing to do.
Right.
Elton John is a campaigner, as well as being a musician, for gay rights. And he has been particularly focused on Russia in recent times because Russia has very poor gay rights. In fact, it has laws banning what it describes as the spread of gay propaganda to children.
And these are relatively recent laws, aren't they?
So, yes. So it's... Lady Gaga fell foul of them a couple of years ago. Where the promoter of one of her shows was fined because she'd apparently broken this law. Madonna also broke this law. Cher refused to go to perform at the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics in Russia because of these laws. And Elton John has on multiple occasions said that he would like to meet Vladimir Putin and discuss his country's record on this.
Yeah, so rather than saying, that's it, I'm never playing Russia ever again, you know, actually...
He's always very... It always comes out and says, I love Russia, I've been performing in Russia since the early 70s, it's got nothing against Russia, I just have real issue with these laws and your attitudes towards...
Yeah, can we have
people.
A conversation? And yes. So he said this earlier in the year, and then he said it again...
Yes, well, this he was in Ukraine, where he addressed... a room full of business leaders where he tried to convince them that they shouldn't sack people because of their sexual orientation, which seems reasonable. And then he also got a meeting with the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko.
Also to discuss the
also
same
to
issues.
Discuss the same issues. And then he did an interview with the BBC where he discussed how he would really like to get a meeting with Vladimir Putin. And that would be kind of top of his list of things to do. He really just wants to sit down and say, look, here... These are silly laws. Gay people are not your problem. There's bigger things in the world, and we could all come together and we could fight these bigger problems together, and that would be great.
And then?
And then,
on Instagram,
a couple of days later, he posted a picture of Putin on Instagram where he said, thank you so much for calling me, Vladimir, to discuss these things. Look forward to meeting up and discussing them further.
So that was good?
That was good and very exciting and... also seemed quite unlikely. and it was quite unlikely.
Although Putin is on Instagram.
Putin is on Instagram.
so he might have connected that
way. Yeah, which is how I know he's been hanging around with Silvio Berlusconi.
But anyway, as this story started to break, the Kremlin then issued a statement saying, this is news to us.
Yeah, we know of no such phone call. That seemed more likely than the phone call in the first place. And so it turned out that it was in fact a prank by a couple of Russian TV presenters. I've still yet to work out what the joke was exactly, but...
Yeah, you sense that they thought that he would immediately realise that it was a joke and they could all have a good laugh about it at the start. But then because Elton John was immediately taken in, and I think also there's almost an accent thing here. I suspect that if someone is talking and in English but with an accent, you're less likely to have the intonation and think, hang on a second, this doesn't sound right, this sounds like a wind-up.
So, yeah, these two guys phoned up, Vladimir Krasnov and Alexei Stolyarov.
You could have just gone with their stage names.
I could have just gone with their stage names, Volvan and Lexus, which are a lot easier, although I just got one of them wrong. Yeah, I could have just gone with their stage names, Volvan and Lexus. That would have been easier. It's not like you know who they are. Anyway, they phoned them up. One of them was speaking Russian. The other one said, I will be your translator. And so... Elton John had a conversation with someone he thought was Vladimir Putin talking in Russian through a translator who was speaking English.
But then because Elton immediately just assumed it was all legit, they then just had what seemed like a normal conversation. Normally, if it winds up, the conversation gets more and more ludicrous as the conversation goes, in the assumption that eventually the person on the other end will go, hang on a second, this can't be real.
Now, I suspect possibly... Well, there's two things possible, really. One is that they thought the joke was that Elton John thought he was talking to the president, and that in itself was just funny, that they were disappointing a man, and that actually Russia still has terrible gay rights record, and that is the joke. The other one, I think, is possibly that they thought the conversation was far more out there and ridiculous than Elton John did, because all they'd really do is, like, it's just admin, really. They kind of... Like a joke like this, the longer it goes on, the longer you would escalate it, and you try to add more and more ridiculous things to the conversation to see how far you could push it before the person realises. However, in this, they just kind of go, oh, Vladimir Putin's on the phone, and Elton John goes, oh, great. And then they start talking, and they say, yes, I would like to discuss these things with you. And Elton John says, well, I don't really want to discuss it on the phone. I'd rather meet you. And they go, well, why don't you come over in November? And we could do this at the same time as the Gay Pride March in Moscow. And that's probably the point at which they thought they were being completely, wow, this is so wacky. Whereas, like, it just kind of sounds like the whole conversation just sounds like admin.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems really...
Well, presumably Elton would be like, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Get our diaries out.
I mean, it does all seem incredibly unlikely considering, like, what everything
we know about the politics
Vladimir Putin has ever
there.
Done. So it doesn't seem that he would have such a sudden change of heart. So that, I guess, is where the joke apparently lies.
Although, but interestingly...
It just doesn't come off as very funny.
Well, perhaps it's cultural.
Well, yeah.
Perhaps, if there are any Russians listening, you go and listen to it and perhaps tell us. Perhaps it's hilarious if you have the cultural references. But, of course, the Kremlin, when issuing their denial that this conversation went place, then added a line of, but if Elton wants to talk to Putin, he should just ask.
Yeah, they said we've received no such signals that he wanted to talk. So he's always going on about it. So we've received the signals.
Perhaps now, with all of this, it might actually happen. Who knows? But anyway...
That would be a happy outcome to
poor
this.
Poor old Elton, 40, was making some progress there.
But no, there's been no progress.
And no comedy either.
And no.
So there you go. That's it for this podcast. I think we should all pack up and go home.
Yeah, just I'll just quickly tell you that if you enjoyed this, and even if you haven't, you should go and rate it 5 stars on iTunes, because that is really actually very helpful, even though it doesn't sound like it would be a helpful thing in getting this podcast heard more widely. You can review it too if you've got a moment. You can share it on your social medias. You could follow us on the social medias. We're at CMU on Twitter. We are Complete Music Update on Facebook.
But sorry, Putin, we're not on Instagram.
We're not. I think we considered it once and then didn't do it.
We have nothing we wish to take a photo of.
It's just true. That's a bombshell to end this on. We don't have an Instagram account. So that just leaves it to me to say that this episode of the CMU podcast, like all of them, was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can visit completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Obviously, it's called Content ID, but all of it is linked to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which we've talked about before on the podcast, which...
Oh, for God's sake.
It's annoying, wasn't it?
Yeah, ruin that.
And all of that is linked to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which we've talked about before on the podcast, which is where the safe harbours. Did it just buzz?
Yeah.
Didn't even hear it. Gonna put it on airplane mode.
Yeah.